Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Welcome to the Polycast focused on Civilization 5. Daniel Quick, known as Dan Q on the forums, and I'm joined by a couple of modcasters here, Tony Garrett and Zach Akeel.
Yo!
And Peter Maniac Steinbaker.
Hello, everyone.
Also, we are joined by representatives from Firaxis Games, the designer on Civilization V, John Schaefer.
Hello, internets.
Greetings, John.
Hey, talk back.
And marketing associate Pete Murray.
Pay no attention to the man behind the marketing associate.
First, definition of a game designer, favorite part of the task, and working relationship between departments developing Civilization V. Then, looking back at previous Civ titles to inform design decisions, and then all about the hex-based grid system, decision to use, progression through, and getting oriented. Next, Civ 5 social policies mechanic, particulars within variety, choice benefits and consequences, and overall balance. Further, future and inception of the Civ 5 in-game modding browser, quality review within and installation of mods, influence of Civ 4's bug mod and transition from that game's Python to Lua programming language in Civ 5, and evolution of Civ's modding capabilities and its furthering Civ 5's world builder, ability to add data to specific objects, and personal preferences for content. Then, challenges and comforts in designing a successor title in an established gaming franchise as compared to one that is new and untested. Comparing Civ 5 to Civ 4 on terrain and maps, and barbarians. Next, setting Civ 5's advisors apart from those found in both Civilization 2 and Civilization Revolution. Three words: giant death robots. John, what is your position at Firaxis Games, and specifically on Civilization V? Well, I know we kind of answered that already. But in more detail, what does a typical workday in your position entail? Ooh, that rhymes.
So, as you noted, I'm the designer for Civ 5. My official title is lead designer and principal gameplay programmer. In terms of what I do day-to-day, that can vary quite a bit, if you couldn't tell from the lengthy title. I spend quite a bit of time doing programming for the game. Generally, the game rules, certain AI subsystems like diplomacy. I go to a lot of meetings. I read and write a lot of emails. Earlier in the project, I did a lot of research and documentation for various systems that were going to be put into place, and just a little bit of everything sometimes. But generally, my main focus is crafting the design for the game and making sure it's fun.
All right, Pete. What is your position at Firaxis, and what exactly do you do for Civ 5? What does your workday entail as well?
Well, I'm the marketing associate here at Firaxis. My job is cool because I get to take the game as we go through various stages of releasing information to people and sort of prepare what we're going to show to the world. So I work very closely with our publisher 2K and the people there, so Greg Laves, the community manager, Elizabeth Toby, our marketing folks. And I get to do things like take the screenshots of the game, gameplay video.
Nice.
Yeah, I have to play Civ 5 a lot, so I'm familiar with it, which is, that's not such a bad job. The story I like to tell people is when I first came to Firaxis, Kelly Gilmore, who's the marketing director, handed me all of the games Firaxis had made since Civ 3 and said, here, I think you need to play these to get familiar with our products over the next few days. And it was like I had died and gone to heaven. It was really, really fantastic. I love what I do.
Well, how could you not if your job is to play video games for a living?
it's not just play video games for a living. It's I have the fun of getting to go out into the world and show people the game as it's being completed, which is a lot of fun because we can be here at work and you get very close to the game and, you know, you see it as it sort of evolves in its iterations and you can take it out and show people at a show. And suddenly you realize the people in this room have not seen any of this before. And it's really exciting to see them get all fired up about seeing Civ 5 for the first time. That's been the part that I've enjoyed the most.
One definition of a game designer has been given as, quote, a person who designs gameplay, conceiving and designing the rules and structures of a game, unquote. Thinking in particular of your work on Civilization V as its lead designer, how accurate and complete is this? What is your definition of a game designer in the industry today?
I think that definition is probably the furthest down that you could refine it. So if you didn't do that, you wouldn't be a game designer. I think in terms of across the industry as a whole, there's a lot of wiggle room in there. What a designer does here at Firaxis, for example, is very different from what a designer might do at another studio like Bethesda making role-playing games.
Mm-hmm.
There's also different types of designers, of course. You have, in some cases, people that design quests or people that design levels or type of design roles, writing dialogue even kind of blurs over into some other fields, but they have elements of design to them. In terms of what I do here specifically, I spoke to that a little bit ago in terms of what I did day to day, but if I had to summarize it, I would say my main job really is to make sure that the experience of playing the game is as good as it can be, and that is a really broad definition. Again, it depends quite a bit what studio at, what game, that sort of thing.
What do you love most? What's your favorite aspect of being the design guru?
Favorite thing would probably be seeing something that you thought up from nothing actually turn out and end up being fun and something that other people enjoy as well. When you start, you really don't have anything. You think about computer software in general or games specifically. There's nothing you really hold or touch or feel. You have to experience playing it. And if you do that and you have fun with something that you've made, that's probably the most rewarding part of being a designer.
And then there's telling other people what to do, right?
Only if they listen.
All right. Let's just say as game scope and vision become more complex and computing technology even more powerful in the decades following the first electronic games, the design and programming roles were split into teams along with production, art, and audio. What has been the working relationship between these groups in Civ 5? How have they been independent while still being dependent on one another? What's the dynamic there?
I'll just say that it's very collaborative here. Yes, everybody has specific aspects of the game that they're focused on working on. You know, the artists are making assets for the games. The programmers have different subsystems that they're working on. But everybody here is playing the game every day. And they're talking about it. And they're giving feedback to John and giving feedback to each other. And they're saying, hey, this looks really cool. Or, hey, is this supposed to be doing this? And it's that relationship, that continued sort of talking to each other and that sort of spontaneous discussion that happens all the time is what goes towards making the game really effective and successful. And I think everybody here has been very mindful that Civilization is a game that has a long heritage and a storied history of its own. And everybody wanted to do justice to, you know, Civilization as a franchise and make sure that Civ 5 was the best foot forward that they could put. It really was in everybody's best interest to make sure that they were talking to each other and problems were getting communicated and things were looking as good as they possibly could.
Was there any substantial organization difference between Civ 5 and what was done with Civ 4 in this respect?
I'll have to let John answer that because Civ 4 predates my tenure at Firaxis by a fair bit.
Well, you can just guess, Pete, and then, you know.
That'll be our accurate information.
Yeah.
Besides, how are the listeners going to know any different? I mean, really.
Well, now that you said that.
Yeah, you've brought everything we've ever said into question. Good job. We will note that only applies to things that Dan has said.
Of course. It's always been the way it works.
Long-time listeners know this.
In terms of how the team was divided up in the different disciplines, it's rather similar. Certain people have changed, of course, but in terms of specific roles, you still have the engineering department, the art department, audio, QA, and people that fit certain roles, like lead graphics programmer, that sort of thing. We still have a lead graphics programmer, as we did on Civ 4, so it's relatively similar.
Oh, okay. Of course, before you were at the bottom, now you are at the top.
Those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. It's an old adage. And while there's always something to be said for taking a new approach or seeking a new goal, Civ 4 lead designer Soren Johnson himself said that he followed the one-third old, one-third improved, and one-third new mantra for sustaining a gaming franchise property. What value have you found in researching and studying what has been done or even just attempted before the Civ franchise and approaching Civ 5's design? How much is too much, if at all, and if so, where do you draw the line? Not to sound confrontational or anything with that last bit.
Oh, that's fine. When we started with Civ 5, we didn't have a specific line, I guess you could say, in mind for what our philosophy was going to be. We knew we wanted to keep the level of complexity about the same level as Civ 4. We didn't want to add a lot more than that. We didn't want to remove a lot from it. So we kind of had that as a target going into the game. In terms of specific things, early on we knew some of the bigger changes that we wanted to make, including the combat system and the hexes and that sort of thing. The city-states are another good example. So as we did some work on those, we knew that we also didn't want the game to become too much bigger. So as we were developing it, we had to be mindful of that and make sure that we didn't just go overboard. For example, with the units, we tried to make sure that the level of complexity with regards to managing individual units is about the same. So you won't have, let's say, 500 promotions or whatever. Promotions was a cool system, but we don't want to go overboard there. Another good example of that with the combat system is because each unit is more important and you have to think more about how you're going to utilize them, we made sure to reduce the overall number of units that you'll be in control of at any time. In earlier Civ games, you could easily have wars involving hundreds of units in a single stack, and that is definitely no longer the case. You have an army of maybe 30 or 40, that's going to be a pretty big force. It's not going to be the ceiling, but as big as 40 or so tiles on the map, which is pretty big. Our main philosophy was to try and keep things about the same while innovating in these areas that we'd identified early on for this is what we want to make Civ 5, this is how we're going to make it different.
So in addition to reducing the number of units themselves that you're going to need, is there also a reduction, I don't want to say number of unit types, because when I think unit types, I think of land, air, water, but just the number of units that you can build, is there a reduction in that too?
No, there's not. I mean, maybe if you compare it against Beyond the Sword, which had several units added in Warlords and Beyond the Sword, it might be fewer than that. But if anything, I think it's actually a little bit more vanilla Civ. We have some units in Civ 5 that weren't in vanilla Civ 4, like Trebuchet or the Paratroopers. So there wasn't a concerted effort to cut down on the number of types. If anything, it's actually a little bit bigger, like I said.
And giant death robots. Oh, getting ahead of ourselves, yes.
The hex and stacking system, did you guys have to look back in the past and play a game of Panzer General or play some hex-based single-stack strategy games to perhaps get ideas for your artillery and whatnot?
It was definitely referenced, yes. I played, obviously, a fair amount of Panzer General in the past, and before starting work on Civ 5, I refreshed my memories with that. I also played a game that some people, I'm sure, will be familiar with, called Battle of Wesna.
Yeah,
my favorite.
It's a good one.
For those who don't know, it's a little indie fantasy hex war game.
100% free. Go download it. It's fun.
Yeah, I played it a couple years ago now. I'm not sure exactly when. But it was something that I was definitely looking at when making decisions for the combat system. We tried out a few different things. Some people I know on the fan forums noted the existence of something called Fear in one of the other demos. That was meant to be something similar to how suppression worked in Panzer General, where if you caused enough fear to an enemy unit, it would retreat from its location. Ultimately, we ended up taking that out because it wasn't exactly clear what was going on all the time. And we kind of got around the issues of having a highly, highly entrenched unit that takes a lot of punishment before it can be uprooted by adding flanking, where if you have multiple units adjacent to an enemy, you get a bonus for each one that you have. And that's something that, for example, Panzer General doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So we started with something that was more similar to the Panzer General combat system, and then it evolved from there into what we now have in Civ 5.
Well, here we are. We're about to get into some serious hex-based combat, Civ style, unheard of. The first game to have hexes. It's going to be a whole new experience, I think, in a lot of ways.
It's different, but the changes feel subtle. They're definitely there, but it's not something where each time you move a unit, you know, after playing for 3 hours, you're like, ooh, hexes, ooh, hexes. I think it's more like something you notice early on when you start playing. You say, that's interesting, or that's cool. And then after having played for a while, you finish up and you think about it, and you're like, yeah, that was pretty neat. I like that they changed that. And I think that's appropriate if you change anything as fundamental as the grid. You don't want people thinking about it every turn. Hexes, end turn. About those hexes.
The other time I noticed that you think about the shape of the game board a lot is when you're trying to besiege a city or break through another guy's line. And there's a very specific order of attack you want to pull off and make sure that, you know, your ranged units stay covered and your melee units stay supported. And it's at that point you're thinking, hexes. But you're not thinking it in the, wow, hexes, how novel. You're thinking, what's the best way I can take the forces I have right now in the configuration they're in and either hit this point as hard as I can or keep him from hitting me as hard as he can. That feels very elegant when you're doing that. That's something that's been very cool for me to play again.
It's you, Pete, here.
Okay.
In a recent video interview with GameSpot, you said that Civ 5's social policy system provides, quote, your civilization with ways you can fine-tune it, unquote, from culture to military to diplomacy. We know some of the extent of the culture element already. Progress far enough down 5 of its paths, and you unlock the Utopia Project to start the final run towards a cultural victory. What more can you tell us about Civ 5's social policies?
Each one of the social policies is set up for boosting a specific style of play. So early on, for example, you can access piety, which improves your happiness in your civilization. In turn, gives you boosts to culture. That's a pretty cool one. That's one I like a lot. Patronage improves your relationships with the city-states. I had fun today playing as the Greeks with their civ-specific boosts to city-state diplomacy, and by unlocking a lot of the branches within the patronage social policy tree, I was essentially able to make lots of friends and influence lots of people, much to the chagrin of everybody who was trying to play with me. Honor is a good one for improving your military early on in the game. It gives you some really good advantages versus barbarians. Beating up a lot of people early on is something you want to do. That will help you out a lot as well, too. I really think what most people will find is that with each civilization and its sort of flavor, its set of things that it does well, there's a good social policy branch or two that will really kind of drive that civilization really hard to do something really, really well. I think that will be very cool for a lot of players. The only one I haven't really used in the course of the game so far is Autocracy, generally because I'm kind of a soft player and don't like the late-game domination match quite as well, because generally I find other people are better at it than I am, usually to an embarrassing degree. I don't know, John, do you have a favorite?
It's hard to say, and that's something that speaks to how cool the system is. Depending on what your game situation is, it can change. At the very beginning of the game, you have three branches that are available to you. Liberty, which helps you expand or gives you bonuses for having a number of cities or expanding. Tradition, which generally gives you bonuses to your capital and makes a smaller empire stronger. And then honor, which Pete talked about, which gives bonuses to your military. The first of which is pretty hefty bonus to fighting the barbarians. Additionally, you also be informed whenever a new barbarian camp spawns. And that's something that can be really useful even if you're not playing a solid military game, because if you know where the camps are, you can go find them and kill them and get the money. And in the meantime, you pretty much don't have anything to worry about from barbarians because you know exactly where they're going to come from. The distinction between those three branches early in the game is, I think, one of the neater things with Civ 5. And it was one of our goals early on to make sure that these choices early in the game were all interesting. Each time you start a game, it's a question of, okay, how do I want to approach this situation? Do you have a really strong capital starting location, and you're next to a big desert, you might benefit more from growing tradition, even if that's not traditionally what you like to go for.
I notice for each one of the social policies, there are, or at least for almost all of them, anyway, there are six types ultimately under each branch that can be unlocked. Is that right?
Yeah, each branch has six nodes, the first of which is just the branch as a whole. You adopt the branch, which costs you culture, and adopting the branch gives you a bonus. And then there are five individual policies under the branch that can then be unlocked. So there's more or less six for each branch. There's 60 effects total in the whole system.
Ah, I see. So, like, if you adopt Liberty to start off with, then training of sellers is increased by 50%. You have that, and then there are five other ones that would then, for instance, under Liberty here, a collective rule red that gives also a food bonus. So then if you went Liberty and then collective rule, then you've got the food bonus plus being able to train settlers increased by 50%?
Right, yes. That is something where we like the civic system in Civ 4, but one of the flaws I felt with it was the fact that you had to give up what you had adopted previously made it a little bit weird, where if you're, say, a new player, you get the little pop-up saying, hey, you can adopt slavery now. Do you want to do that? And so often what I would see with players is they would either always switch or they would never switch, just because these came up so frequently that they weren't able to get their brain grasped around it to understand what the implications were. So something that we want to do with the policies was make sure there was always a sense of forward momentum. You have to think carefully about which branch you want to open up or which specific policy you want to adopt. But it's a question of which bonus do you want, rather than, okay, do I want to give up something to get this other bonus? What's it worth? Am I actually going to be worse off if I switch or not? All of that is kind of replaced with this. There are more policies than civics by quite a number, so it's not a simplification of the system, but it is definitely a rearranging.
It definitely needed to be done.
It's something that probably been quoted in other places with this, where we kind of liked what was done in World of Warcraft, we kind of liked what was done in Company of Heroes, and we kind of tried to aim for a middle ground in between, where you're going along through this tree or through these branches, you have the choice of what you want to pick, and you never unpick something, you're adding to it. Obviously, World of Warcraft has something going for it. They've done all right for themselves, so indicates that would be a good thing to take a look at. So we did.
You mentioned you started with tradition, liberty, and honor. So if you chose liberty, then is it correct in that you've chosen liberty, so then you could decide to go to tradition or honor, but then you would be giving up the liberty? Is that right?
Not in that case, no.
Ah.
You can have those at the same time. There are certain branches that won't work at the same time.
Ah.
For example, liberty and autocracy. You switch to autocracy, you have to switch out of liberty if that's what you picked earlier in the game. So there's some planning that you'll want to do ahead of time to make sure that certain policies that you pick down the road aren't going to undo the strategy that you had been going with early in the game. There's a little bit more to consider there. I know that's one of the concerns people have had is, how can I be a democratic dictatorship? That doesn't make sense. Well, there are certain combinations that aren't possible, so we want to make sure that it wasn't completely ridiculous.
That's a good simplification of the dynamic that just works. I think that just really works.
We wanted to make the branches that were mutually exclusive kind of force you down different paths, too. So one example is the Piety and Rationalism are two of the branches. Piety earlier in the game, Rationalism later. Piety is dedicated more to happiness and culture and that sort of thing. Rationalism is focused more on science. So if you had adopted Piety in the past, you can choose to kind of lose that, adopt Rationalism, and give yourself a science boost for the rest of the game, trying to go for the spaceship or whatever. But if you know ahead of time how you're going to approach the game, let's say you do know you're going to go for rationalism, then it's better for you to kind of steer in a different direction early on, maybe go further down one of the other three early branches instead of opening up piety, and then once you get far enough in the game, then go for rationalism. Something else that players can do is, instead of buying policies immediately with their culture, they can choose to save up and buy a bunch later. It's hard to say whether that's a better strategy or not, but it's possible. If you're just sitting on all those culture points, you could have bonuses for that time while you're waiting. But if you really want to just unlock the entire rationalism branch at once, you can save up the culture to do it.
That's kind of reminding me now of Civ 4 strategy of binary research.
just scaling back, although rather than inputting in science, just sitting around making a whole bunch of gold and then investing a whole bunch in a particular technology once, say, in the early game, you built the library full. So then what you're investing in terms of technology is 25% more than if you didn't have it without a library. So I can already see lots of strategy articles coming out with regards to social policy.
Yeah, but you won't be able to do that specifically, though, because there's no slider now.
Yes, that's true. Thanks for reminding me, John.
I'm happy anytime. My pleasure.
Because there hasn't been a lot that's come out about, you know, within each social policy branch, specifics about in terms of what they will give you. What really got my attention is under patronage and the educated elite, where it talks about allied city-states sometimes gift you great people.
I love that one. That one is so great. It's like, here, have a great artist. It's like, what? Thank you. Thank you, Florence. I always wanted one of these.
Yes, that one was a little tricky to balance. We had some issues with that in the first version of it. I was playing a game and I was getting a free great person every 5 turns, which is a bit much, so we had to tone that down quite a bit. But it was resolved and it's in a better place now. It is definitely a fun one, though.
Because religion was a major gameplay element in Civ 4 and in other Civ iterations a little bit, it was represented through one or more technologies, only such as ceremonial, burial, monotheism, theology. In Civ 5, is religion going back to this form of war corporation, or is it gone altogether?
The way religion is represented in Civ 5 is mainly through the policies tree at this point. Kind of wanted to play on the sense of being a religious leader or not a religious leader, but something that I've mentioned in the past in some other interviews is that with the way religion worked in Civ 4, we didn't think that it fit as well with what our goals were for diplomacy in Civ 5, where the AIs are generally more focused on, I guess, pragmatic matters. They're not going to hate you just because they hate you. They're going to hate you because, you know, you settled a city too close and you grabbed iron from them that they really wanted. Things that human players would recognize as aggressive actions or just behavior that, say, the AI could be as smart as you possibly want it to be. If you do certain things to them, they should realize that you're not being a good neighbor and that there are going to be problems between you. So that's kind of the spirit that we wanted to capture. And the biggest role that religion had in Civ 4 was in defining diplomatic blocks of players. So if you were Buddhist and Gandhi was Buddhist, that would almost always mean that you were going to be good friends. Almost never would he attack you. There are really rare exceptions, but that was nearly always how it went. We just didn't feel that level of control, that mechanical nature, was something that fit as well with what we were trying to do. So the AIs will be more rational in terms of how they approach the situation, and you do have to be a little bit more careful with how you approach the game. You can't just settle your cities all over the place and have relations that would be just the same as if your borders ended up meeting throughout the game later from normal expansion. If you're aggressive, they'll notice that, and there'll be things that you have to deal with there. More than anything, it was a matter of a philosophical shift in terms of how we thought diplomacy. That having been said, we didn't just then drop it at that point and say, okay, we're not going to have that, then religion's out. We actually looked into finding a role for it and tried out some things. The problem was that the system as it was in Civ 4, it worked well enough, but it was so dependent on that diplomatic aspect that taking that out made it feel very empty. And at that point, you were just kind of going through the motions and collecting extra money and collecting extra happiness, and it was something that we didn't feel was adding to the game.
That's something I was wondering about. There are still other ways to make other Civ like you? I mean, you mentioned lots of ways to make other Civ dislike you.
The big thing is that they'll sometimes make requests of you based on the situation. You know, let's say you're near Gandhi and then also near Montezuma. Let's say Gandhi and Montezuma are getting along for whatever reason. Maybe Montezuma settled near him. Gandhi come up to you and ask to form a pact of cooperation. And in doing that, that pretty much means that you become friends for the time being. Being opportunistic is the best way to grow your relations with different players. You can also be proactive about it, though. If you want, you can go and ask to form Pacts of Cooperation. Pacts of Cooperation, you can go and fight their enemies. You can offer to make research agreements and sign open borders and trade luxuries. So there are still definitely ways that you can try and foster relations. The big difference with Civ 5 is that you have to be more mindful of how your behavior might make for bad relations with another player. In the previous games, that was really not as much of an issue. They weren't perceptive enough to know when you were dealing dirty. Now they have a little bit more of an eye on the human, so you have to balance the good with the bad, and if you really want to make friends with a player, you might really want that source of gold near him, but claiming it's going to make an enemy of them, you have to decide what it's worth to you. And that's kind of something that I feel hasn't been represented very well in the past, and it's something that is a pretty nice change.
It's like an emotional AI or something. AI you can actually make mad.
Yeah.
I was rather thinking about balance of power, like 19th century.
Yes.
I guess that's also your area of studies. Perhaps you were trying to go in that direction.
Part of it, yeah. I wouldn't say that I specifically had in mind saying, all right, I want to make the diplomatic system of Civ 5 mirror what it was in the 19th century. But because that is an area of history that I've studied, because I know so much about it, it just has kind of blended with my style of designing games. I think having that sort of element is a good thing in any sort of strategy game where diplomacy makes sense. You just kind of expect that you're going to see that. That's when diplomacy is most interesting.
Blizzard Entertainment has announced its intention to allow people to sell their high-quality mods on Battle.net. Could Firaxis eventually move in that direction too, with a mod browser and Civ 5 being the first step in creating such a marketplace?
That's really a decision that's going to have to be made by 2K, who's our publisher. Our intention with creating the mod repository on the mod browser was just to be able to take all of the great material people have brought to Civilization and make it accessible within the game itself. We really just had in mind to create a system to bring that to light for a lot of people. And I know since John has done plenty of modding in his day, that was important from the beginning.
Yeah, it originally came out of one of the ideas that we were talking about a few years ago on how we could really boost the presence of modding with Civ, because we do acknowledge how important it is, and we tried to make it more accessible in terms of making mods, but also, given how popular mods already are, making it even easier for players to go and find them was something we thought was a really neat idea. At that point, you had things like the Spore community system that was being talked about, or it was about to come out. So there was talk in that direction, how players could share their experience a little bit more, and this was just something that came out of that. And we just thought it was something that was cool back then, and hopefully people will get to see it here soon.
I'm wondering a couple things that might be on some of the listeners' mind. A, is there any peer/admin review of the quality of mods? And B, is there going to be like an installation widget that's going to install mod, just double click a mod in the repository and then an installer pops up and starts downloading from a server?
Without going into too much of it, obviously the intention is to review the material going into the mod repository with very in-depth stuff like DLL changes going into a sandbox prior to going into the mod repository, and that's simply to make sure that people aren't embedding malicious code within the mod itself.
Mm-hmm.
The processes for reviewing the exact content are still sort of in the finalization phases, so I don't want to speak to that too completely. We do have a very cool system called Mod Buddy, which is if you make something as a mod, you can package it all up using this Mod Buddy and upload it, and then it will be able for people to browse and double-click and install it within the game itself.
That's sharp. That's clever.
Yeah, we have one of our programmers named Sean Seckman has been really focused on this, and this is kind of his baby. He's really excited about it, so he's put a lot of work into it. That system should be pretty neat when it's out there.
And it really is all about making those mods just faster and easier to get in the game. And then for the mod authors, having a sort of last check, if you will. So the last process is you just bundle everything up with Mod Buddy and send it up, and then it's sort of uniform going in and uniform coming down. That's pretty cool. That's a very efficient way to distribute the mods.
Yeah, that's true, because as a mod designer, the majority of questions you have to answer are, how do you install this thing? Before I made a self-executable file, that was basically the majority of the forum talk. This will be an advantage for all mod designers too, I think.
Yeah, the mod packaging stuff is useful even if you don't go into the mod browser in the game. If you just want to distribute these on your own or upload them to different fan sites, that's fine as well. It's not attached to the mod browser.
So if someone installs a mod and then they decide they want to uninstall it, would there be like a comparable uninstaller, a backup made of any game files that have been overwritten perhaps as a result of installing that mod in the first place?
Well, the way it'll work in the game is that you'll have a list of mods that you have available and what's active and what's not, so you can just kind of flick things on and off from in there. So it's pretty streamlined. You shouldn't have to go poking around your SNL folder and moving things around and making backups.
No.
Unless
you want to.
You do it yourself. Yeah, if you want to, you can, but you don't have to.
Two things. Number one, for those who don't know, shame on them, Sean Sackman, modding programmer on Civ 5. And number two, you know when you said Mod Buddy, I just had this vision of this animated cursor on the screen, like Microsoft's Clippy and the dog just running around on the screen. I'm sorry.
Well, imagine if Clippy was actually helpful and made awesome civilization mods instead of unhelpful suggestions like, it looks like you're composing a letter. Would you like a comma? Here? Now? Huh? Why are you dismissing me? I don't understand.
I was nice. I helped you.
I think it would be great if it was on the screen and it was like, it looks like you're not playing Civilization 5 right now. Would you like to play? And then the options are yes and okay.
Yes or one more turn.
Did you look at the bug mod for Civ 4 when deciding what information to display?
We've definitely taken a look at it. The biggest thing with that mod is that it in many ways tries to add every knob possible, which is certainly useful for some players, but can be intimidating for a lot of other players.
Yeah, that's true.
Something that we've done, anybody interested probably in that sort of thing should probably be aware of at this point, is that we've gone from Python to Lua. In the process, all of our UI was written in Lua and XML. There's nothing that's hard-coded in C++, and it's well-organized, it's well-documented. I think people that are looking to make UI mods for Civ 5 will be really impressed by what they find when they start taking a look at the game. So in terms of the modding side, I think that's going to be one of the bigger, cooler things. You even have things like the leader diplomacy screen, which was completely, you know, off limits in the past, is now just a few Lua files and a few XML files, and there it's all right there. So we're looking forward to see what people will do. There's certainly more that can be done with Civ 5 in that regard than there was with Civ 4.
Wow, John, you're really speaking Tony and Peter's language.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm getting really excited.
One of the cool parts is that the fact that this is highly moddable, it's almost as a consequence of the approach that was taken during development. During development, we knew we needed to iterate on the user interface a lot, and so the decision was made early on to adopt that particular approach to the design of the UI. And so then our UI designer was able to iterate very quickly and was able to find things that worked really well over different versions of the game. And now we're just taking his tools and opening that up to players. That's incredibly cool. You guys are working with the same tools that we're working with here.
Yeah. Having worked on the UI for both Civ 4 and Civ 5, I'm definitely happier with how things are done in Civ 5.
It's like we unlocked a new tech in the tech tree. Easy UI modding.
Nice.
What do you think of the evolution and current state of the Civilization modding community? Strengths, weaknesses, room for improvement? How do you see Civ 5 contributing to its furthering, refinements, and how does it all compare to other modding communities and PC gaming, and why?
I think that with Civ 4, we've already seen a lot of amazing things, so I'm not sure there's a ton of room there for doing more. Players can already go and dig through the game code and rewrite the AI and rewrite the game rules, and people have done that. It's hard to be able to do more than you can there. So what our direction going into Civ 5 was, as we explained a little bit ago, is trying to make it more open and more accessible to people, both in terms of how easy is it to mod and how easy is it to get your mod in the hands of other people to play it. So that's kind of what the mod browser's attempting to do. It's kind of what ModBuddy, where it can package up your mod into one file and you can install it, and so you don't have to worry about, you know, what directory does this go in, whatever. So that was our big focus in terms of evolving the mod side of Civilization, and we think that that's worked out really well.
You're going to like the World Builder. The World Builder is so easy, the marketing associate can use it to build demos.
So you actually did a whole interface. Oh, okay.
Yeah, something that's definitely worth noting, and something I wanted really early on, was to actually have a map editor. Anybody who used the World Builder in Civ 4, which was integrated with the game, was probably frustrated at some point or another, especially if it involved putting rivers. Just wait until you see how you place rivers in Civ 5. You're going to weep manly tears, I guarantee it.
The World Builder is a thing of beauty. It is incredibly powerful. It's incredibly easy to use. You get done, you have one file, you go into the mod system, you fire it up, and your world comes alive. And speaking from a more practical perspective, when you have things to do like screenshots, there's very few tools that are quite as powerful as an easy-to-use map editor that lets you set up a really cool situation in a really short period of time.
That also explains to those of you who have been analyzing screenshots and videos where mechs are fighting on one side of the map or modern armor, and you have cavalry and cannons on the other. That's Mr. Murray over here at work.
But it's just so cool to see a mech fight cavalry. I mean, who wouldn't do that?
Something else that I'll add is we talked earlier about how Sean Seckman is an engineer dedicated to the modding stuff. We also have another engineer named Eric Jordan who was dedicated to the World Builder, and that was his primary job for most of development.
Wow.
And it really shows there's a lot of amazing things that it can do. The ability to import maps from Civ 4 has already been talked about. That's something that I really wanted to have. The biggest thing for me probably would be, having worked on Civ 3 maps, would be the ability to undo and redo. You can do that all the way to the beginning of your map. It just records the commands that you input.
Nice.
It saves so much time. You don't have to throw it out if you place something accidentally, because there's no way to undo it.
Built-in event system, perhaps, in the World Builder or in any kind of interface you plan on doing?
We don't have an event system specifically built into it. You do have Lua scripting, as we did in Civ 4, where it was Python. But something that we do have is Eric added the ability to add special mod data to different objects in the World Builder.
Ah.
Let's say you built a mod, and let's say that mod assumes that on a plot or a tile of the map, you're going to have special information. Like, let's say you have an integer for what type of weather is going on this plot.
Mm.
You can set that data in the World Builder outside of the game, and it will read that in and use it. That will be possible. That really wasn't in Civ 4.
So you're going to be able to assign stuff to a specific hex. That's pretty cool.
That's going to be something that will require a little bit more knowledge as to how the system works and a little bit more experience with the modding system as a whole. But in addition to making the modding more accessible, we also wanted to try and find a few areas where we could continue to push and make the tools more powerful. And that was one of the things that we found that we could do.
Is there a specific type of mod you'd like to see developed in Civ 5? For instance, a fantasy mod like Fall from Heaven? Are you hoping for something even more popular?
Personally, I like seeing anything. It's just great when you have people interested in the game and that enjoy it so much that they're willing to dig in and make stuff for it, almost as though they're working on the game themselves. It becomes theirs in a sense. In terms of specific mods, there's nothing that I'm really crossing my fingers. I hope somebody does X, mainly because I know that X is going to get made anyways, just because we have such a big and awesome community that it will get made because somebody will want to do it. There's no need to be worried.
And I think the other cool part about the community is inevitably they'll come up with something that's cooler than we can sit here and try to project from this point of time. So that's one of the things I'm looking forward to. So I'm sure there's somebody who will pick up this set of tools and make something that's completely blows our expectations away. Sets a new bar for what you can do with modding and Civilization.
Mm-hmm. John, in what ways was it more of a challenge and a comfort to design a successor title in an established gaming franchise, such as Civilization, as compared to a new title altogether?
For me, it was definitely a good thing. When I first started designing Civ 5, I'd just turned 22, and at that point, I'm not really sure I could have designed a game that wasn't a Civ game. You know, I've only been around for so many years, and making games is not easy. Fortunately, I've had the benefit of having played the game series for quite a number of years prior to that, so I knew Civ very well when I started Civ 5. Have, say, been starting on a first-person shooter or something. Who knows how it would have turned out? I'm not sure I want to. This being Civ was a big advantage for me in that sense. I kind of knew what I was doing. I had ideas on what I wanted to do instead of just having to figure it out all on my own. That having been said, Civ is a big deal. It's a big franchise. There are a lot of expectations, a lot of people looking forward to the game, so you just have to try and do your best and make sure that you live up to that legacy. So I think we've done it. Everyone will be able to find that for themselves here soon.
Comparing Civ 5 to Civ 4 is not only inevitable, but also helpful, even practical, to try to understand what we don't know and what many of us do know. Starting with terrain and maps, what are the similarities, differences between Civ 4 and Civ 5?
Obviously, the look has changed a little bit. That will be the first thing that's noticed. Number two would be that there's hexes, shock. Other than that, there aren't a ton of changes. We've tweaked the yields from various terrain types. We've added marsh to the game.
I'm trying to remember, was marsh in Civ 3?
Yes, it was added in one of the expansions.
As I remember, it was a pretty useless terrain.
Yeah, it serves a little bit more of a role this time around, mainly because of how the combat system works. It's a rough terrain, so it slows units down, but it's also a flat terrain, so it doesn't confer a defensive bonus. It's actually a really good place to defend, just because if an enemy passes through there, they're going to be in big trouble if you're nearby.
Build a castle right in the middle of a swamp.
Yeah, you could do that. It's not prime real estate, though. You don't want to build your cities too close. There are a number of buildings which can only be constructed if you have a city in a certain location. For example, you can only construct an observatory in a city if it's next to a mountain. That kind of plays into how you plan where you build your cities. You know that you have a mountain nearby, you can count for that ahead of time, and down the road you'll be able to get a bonus for it.
What about maps? Actually, I haven't seen actually much of anything, if anything at all, talked about in terms of the different map types in Civ 5, the different sizes, the different options within, say, that we had within Civ 4.
It's pretty much standard. We have a lot of the same scripts that we had in previous games. Something new that we're going to have an Earth map available right from the main menu, and you'll be able to choose what size that you want for it, too. So if you want to play on a huge Earth, if you want to play on a tiny Earth, whatever, those are available right in the basic setup of the game. So people that enjoy that will have that right at their fingertips. Should be something that is really exciting. Something that when I was playing a lot of Civ 3, I liked to play a lot on the Earth map, so that was something that kind of caught my eye, and I always wanted to do that, so Civ 5 gave us that opportunity.
Starting locations?
For these maps, it's going to be more or less randomized. It's certainly possible to add that to the World Builder files, but these ones are designed to be random resources, random goody huts, random start locations, that sort of thing.
Nice.
Enough variety there that you can keep playing them.
We kind of alluded to Barbarians already with under the social policy. We've seen that there is actually a Barbarian unit called a Brute, movement 2, strength 6. But at the same time, you could also have Barbarian units that are more or less at the strength of whatever era your particular civilization is. So there are Brute units, and then you could have Barbarian swordsman unit and horse archer units, etc., those kind of things.
Barbarian battleships?
Ooh!
As you know, they are just art variations. We wanted to cover the early game, which is when you're going to see the barbarians the most. The likelihood of seeing a barbarian battleship is low enough that we didn't feel it was necessary to have a special unit just for that. But everybody in the ancient era should be covered. We want to make sure they looked a little bit more menacing and a little bit more scary than the normal units.
So wait, is there a small but existing possibility that you can see a barbarian giant death robot?
I was thinking the same thing.
There was one test done in QA. It was an auto run, I think, where the barbarians developed the bomb.
Okay.
And used it on somebody.
Beware.
So make sure you roll that fog back.
That should be an achievement, get nuked by a barbarian.
To go back to the base honor branch, whenever a barbarian encampment appears in territory you've seen before, that's when you get the notification. If you've explored the continent and you can't see it all because you don't have 500 units, but a camp spawns on the other end, if you've seen that tile before, the game will let you know that barbarians have appeared over here.
Ah, so do barbarians, can we do the spawn-busting thing like we were able to do in Civ 4 then, since we're talking about barbarians?
Yep, it's possible. It's probably more effective to go honor and then just hunt them down because by themselves they're pretty easy to take out, and you can rack up quite a bit of gold that way. Anybody who's really interested in kind of a barbarian-centric strategy, that's not a bad way to go.
Ah, okay. That's actually even reminding me a little bit of Civilization Revolution there, especially in the early game, the Attack of the Huns scenario specifically.
Yeah.
For those listening to the show and are familiar enough with the game to know what it is I'm talking about.
Yeah, we pulled a couple things like that. We were a fan of the camps in Civ Rev, and for me specifically in Civ 3, I think they offered good targets early on. In Civ 4, there were the barbarian cities, obviously, but the thing that I was concerned about was having those be confused with the city-states. Actually, having the city-states where there are these minor powers just scattered about in the world, it's new, and it's going to be a little bit challenging for some people to pick up. So we didn't want to have yet another category of cities. Oh, these cities are neutral. They won't try to win the game. These cities belong to another major power. And these cities, you can attack anytime, and they can attack you. It's just a lot. We felt that we could still have the world filled up like it was in Civ 4 with cities, but kind of have the barbarians play more of a role of thwarting and challenging players rather than filling the map up. So we kind of split those two and differentiated them a little bit more.
I haven't really talked about civilizations in Civ 5 yet, because there's so many other things to talk about, but Germany, the Ottomans, and the Songhai all have some sort of element to them that relates to barbarians. Like Germany, on defeating a barbarian unit in their encampment, you have a 50% chance of converting the unit to your side, as well as receiving 25 gold. So does that mean then that even without the Germans, if you defeat a barbarian unit, you could have them converted to your side, that they're not necessarily killed?
Yeah, that's unique to the Germans. The thing that's shared is the gold.
Ah, so just like with the Ottomans, so if a barbarian naval unit come into your side, a 50% chance, same thing.
Yes, they're the only ones that have that ability.
Ah, okay. And then the Songhai, for completeness sake, you receive triple gold from barbarian encampments and from pillaging cities. So, whoo.
Yep.
And we mentioned city-states. One of the missions you can undertake for them, our understanding is defending them from barbarians, in fact.
Yes. If there are barbarians in their vicinity, they'll put out a cry for help. And for every barbarian that you kill in or near their territory, you'll earn a certain amount of influence with them. So that's a particular role you can take if you want to go and protect them, just because that's how you like to play. Or specifically, if you want to earn influence, you can do it for that reason as well. That's one of the things that they'll make a request for. They also ask you to go and find a specific camp near them and kill it, such that it won't cause them future problems. So those are the two separate things. So.
It has been noted in some previews for a number of months that advisors have a notable presence in Civ 5, that their tone is to be more serious than was found with them in Civ 2 or even Civ Rev. What is their presence in appearance and practice?
I know one of the design goals for Civilization 5 was to have your advisors feel trusted, feel like people that you could really turn to give you solid advice. And I think, consequently, adopting a more serious tone with them made a lot more sense in that context. They're very elegantly presented in their portraits. When you go to your advisors and ask for their advice, they're very sensitive to what's going on in the game, and they'll give you information and their advice based on what the current situation is. When you go to build new units, there's little icons next to the various things you construct that represent what your various advisors think might be valuable at that particular point, which is always useful. For new players, especially since we are really making an effort to bring a lot of new people to Civilization, I think that's going to be something that they come away saying, wow, I was really glad those advisors were there. Those guys were cool. They knew what they were doing. I was glad I listened to them. Part of that is because the advice the advisors give you is based on what we know about how people play Civ. That's kind of the cool thing, is we're taking the years and years of experience people have playing Civ games, and we've codified them in the advisors in Civ 5.
Their logic for a number of things is based off of what we use for the AI as well. So it's useful in that sense because it gives us a view into what the AI is doing. So there's a tangential benefit there as well. Pete mentioned that the advisors in Civ 5 are not silly like they were in Civ Rep, but it's not to say that there's not a little bit of humor to them. Our gameplay programmer, Scott Lewis, who worked on that system, wanted to make sure that there was a little bit of character in there as well. So it's not like reading a textbook or anything like that. There's a little bit of fun in there.
If you want kind of a good example of that humor, I would suggest checking with your advisors before you found your first city and listen to what your science advisor has to say. I stumbled across that the other day, and I laughed and got everybody else in the office to read it because I thought it was that funny. So,
Does it come with insults?
No, they're very respectful of you. I mean, you're...
They want to get fired.
Oh.
They know who's boss.
Pete, tell us the story of how giant death robots ended up in Civ 5.
Giant death robots are awesome. I'm not sure at what point they exactly materialized, but at some point somebody said, yeah, there will be mechs in the game. And that was a very awesome moment for me. John, was there a particular decision that was made?
Yes, I wanted them in. That's why they're in. And then it was done.
So out of bed in the morning and said, I want a giant death robot.
You know, it's a very, very cool unit. And it's cool that our tech tree sort of extends into the future as we see it now, and that there is a military unit that you can build once you're in that part of the tech tree. The designer for it, Mike Bates, had been building all of the unit, tank and armor units in the game up to that point. So the design of it was really sort of based on his having labored through military hardware. And I think what he came up with is a very cool, iconic design. It's cool enough that we wanted to make it into a miniature for the retail limited edition of it. When you hold that mech in your hand, it's a nice, solid piece of metal. And
if you throw it, you could kill someone with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Pete's tried. He missed. But not for lack of effort. The giant death robot, though, does have a specific role. It is designed to kind of be the end game unit if you're going for a military victory. It requires uranium, which you generally don't have very much of, so you're not going to have armies of these. You might only have one or two or three, and they are quite powerful. But they don't have a humongous role to play in the game. They're almost kind of an end-game mop-up unit, so you have to get pretty much to the very end, and the other guy's going to launch a spaceship in 8 turns, and you better get your death robot over there in time. So it's a bit of an Easter egg, but it also has a legitimate role in the game. The current modern age units kind of climax with the modern armor and the stealth bomber, and you kind of wanted to up the ante a little bit more there and give something, really make the military player want to keep pushing and further into the tech tree.
I saw that there are 3 movement strength, 150, and I think the next strongest unit with strength is the modern armor at 80, so that gives our listeners some idea of just how giant, deathy, and robot-y they really are.
Nice.
They have some of the coolest combat animations in the game, too. For me personally.
Yeah, they're the official testing combat unit. It's like, we need to kill these barbarians. All right, you know what you need to do.
So this is only tangentially related, but is there advanced starts in Civ 5?
You can start in the later eras, just like you could in Civ 4. Yep.
So we don't have to wait for a giant death robots or jump into the world builder. We could just...
You don't have to, no. It's not necessary.
Nice.
Although it's more fun when you have to work for it.
There's nothing quite like an earned giant death robot.
Yes, something special about that.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Well, you guys heard it. You got to buy the collector's edition of Civ 5 to get the metal dude, and we all want the metal figurine.
You do. They're awesome. They're very, very cool.
My pre-order's in. I'll say it. I'd say where I pre-ordered it from, but, you know, they don't sponsor the show, so forget it.
That is enlightened self-interest right there.
But they can start any time.
Oh, dear. We should add ink as a resource.
No.
Expansion packs.
That will not happen.
Printer ink. Cartridges floating around the map.
OP, you can make that. You can make that mod. I won't stop you from doing
that. You won't stop me, yeah. Because it'll stop its publication.
I'll stop you from doing other things, but not that.
But not that. Okay.
Is there a question that you have not been asked to date but wished you had? And then what is the answer to that question?
I would probably say a good question would be, do you like meat? And the answer is yes. I love beef. So if you want to be on my good side, send me steak or something like that.
We should also point out, we just got a grill here at the office, and there has been at least one and possibly two meat clubs started since then.
Nice.
People keep bringing in exotic pieces of protein and putting them on the grill and making this wonderful smell. From about 11 o'clock in the morning until about 2 in the afternoon, all sorts of marvelous things are being turned into delicious food. So we have the meat luxury resource here at work.
But we can't share it.
Oh, sure.
It will not be traded.
Maybe it's a strategic resource. Maybe we should call it a strategic resource instead.
The meat has been redded out.
John, do you regret coming back on Polycast?
Oh, Dan, I could never regret anything where I get to talk to you.
Aww. Touching.
I got something in my eye.
We've even got tender moments here on Polycast.
This is something moment, but that company doesn't sponsor the show either, so I can't say their name, but you all know what we're talking about.
See, we've got something for everybody here.
Group hug.
Pete, was it as bad as you thought it would be, being on Polycast?
No, you guys are great. I love it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to talk to you guys. It's great what you do for Civ and for the community as a whole. It's a great opportunity to get here and talk with you guys and share the love.
Thank you both. John Schaefer, lead designer on Civilization V, and marketing associate Pete Murray from Fraxis Games. Thanks also to Garrett Sasaka and Maniac, my fellow interviewees here from Modcast panel, and to everybody out there in the interwebs. A, if you regret listening to this, too bad, you already did. But more importantly, thank you very much for tuning in. Civilization V Worldwide, September 21st, 2010.
Nice.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Dan.
Goodbye, everybody.
Peace.
See you later.
So, John?
Yes, hello. Who am I speaking to right now?
It's Dan.
Oh, hello, Dan. It's been a little while.
You obviously don't listen to the podcast enough.
I do. I couldn't hear your Canadian-ness.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't have enough. How's it going, eh?
Oh, damn. Okay.
Yeah. So is your laptop fan going to be making a guest appearance on the show?
It will not be. That computer has been retired for years now.
You knew I was going to have to make reference to that.
Sounds like the toilets on the airplane.
It does. It does.
I don't know. Sounds like a jet plane without a muffler or something.
Yeah, jet plane without a muffler is right.
That'll be good. For a change.
Thank you.
Just don't ask us about Civ 7, all right? Because we can't talk about it.
Now, you got that, Tony and Peter. You said they can't talk about it, which means there isn't it. So that means you guys have...
This interview is now at an end. No.
That means you've totally forgotten about Civ 6 because the pressure will be too much to follow up from Civ 5. So you're going straight to Civ 7. You've heard it first on Polycast, world exclusive.
Nice job.
I'm sorry.
You'd never make my life easy.
My job is to make your life hard.
Since success! Anyway, moving right along.
Even more powerful in the decades following the first electronic games, the design and programming roles were split into teams along with production, art, and audio.
Yeah, and then what has been the...
We agree with that statement.
That's like...
True.
That's not a question. Yeah, I'm pretty excited too, actually.
That your kit isn't.
Someone else is excited.
Each one of the social policies is sort of set up. It's not sort of set up. It is set up for...
I think something that we may need to see is a zombies mod. That's all the rage these days with the children, so I think that's something that we really need to see, ladies and gentlemen. More zombies.
More zombies.
And a Polycast mod. What? Who said that?
What would that be? What would you do? We'll replace all the leaders and all the advisors with pictures of Dan.
This sounds wonderful.
I have to go to Gamescom in Germany with John, and I want to stay on his good side.
Pete has told me that I'm not going to be returning from Germany, though I'm not quite sure what that means yet.
You'll find out, I'm sure.
Oh, Pete. Look after my hamster. I don't own a hamster, but it's silly.
Tony, did you want to ask that question?
Tony.
Boy, yes I do, Dan. Well, that's great, Tony. Why don't you go?
Okay, yeah.
Giant stompy robots doing their giant stompy thing, which will be pretty cool to see.
They don't have EMP blast to render everyone immobile or anything like that. They're just a big, strong guy. But it is required that they fight in Tokyo, though. That is not optional. That is the only city from which they can be built.
He's not serious.
Or am I? It's not done yet, Pete. Anything can be changed.
Oh, John.
Will Civ 7 include spherical worlds? Globes?
I can't talk about that, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's still secret? That's...
It would be too premature to talk about non-Euclidean geometry maps and things like that.
We wouldn't want to blow anyone's mind.
I think if you're using a giant death robot against cavalry, it's more than a foregone conclusion at that point.
That may be overkill.
Or you're testing combat, one or the other.
Yes. Either way is fine. No one will judge you.
Unless it's a spearman the giant death robot is fighting. Oh, I'm sorry.
If you give it the anti-death robot promotion, then he'll be in good shape.
There's no anti-giant death robot unit promotion.
Aww.
See, I gotta work with Pete. All he does is try to make life less fun.
I'm not
These days, it's good for most of the world, but there's not really a whole lot of diplomatic intrigue going on anymore.
I don't know, we're really turning to balance of power. That's another topic, of course.
Yeah.
Are you sure you don't want to go on for another couple hours?
Yeah, we'll let these guys get back to work so they can get us a game. Where's a game? Let's get it.
The whole Civ 5 thing, by the way, guys, it's just kidding. It's just a joke. April Fools.
Oh!
He's joking about the April Fools thing.
I don't know, it's either a little late or a little early for April Fools. I mean, I realize it is August, and the month also starts with A, but...
We've been saving up Aprils.
They bring all the...
Whoa. Pete, that's going to be at the end of this podcast. I hope you know that.
Oh, no! I'd like to remind everybody that Firaxis Marketing needs to review the podcast before it goes live.
You think that's going to help you? No.
Don't worry, Pete. I'll just talk to Kelly behind your back, and she'll approve it. She'll override you. It's too bad. Sorry.
Oh. My brief but lucrative career in podcasting.
Lucrative. Record date August 13th, 2010. Civilization 4, Civilization 5, and Civilization Anonymous clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.